Good evening and welcome to Local Motion, where we go in depth with local public affairs from around the KVNF listening area. I'm Laura Palmisano. On August 20th, Governor John Hickenlooper and members of his cabinet came to Montrose to speak at a community forum. Today on the show, we'll hear speeches from that event. First up is Irv Halter, the executive director of the Colorado Department of Local Affairs.
And it's really great. I mean, today, before coming here, I got a chance to go through our work that we've done, partnered with Hope West. Hope West, as you know, provides great hospice services here. We were able to give them a $400,000 grant, along with a lot of the money they brought in on a $3 million project that has now opened up down near the hospital. Great facility, doing great work for citizens up all around this region, not just Montrose. So a great thing. There are other things here. Just recently, we were able to put an energy impact grant for $5.2 million. Just signed it about 2 weeks ago, and that will help get broadband through the middle mile and out in this region even further. So, and really, both the county commissioners and others in that group of folks, a really large region of folks really came together, put together a great plan, and we were happy to help them with that project. And that project, by the way, is going to be over $9 million. One of the things I remind folks about DOLA is we're the with guys. Government can do things to you, and sometimes that's necessary. It does things for you, especially if you're in big need. But what we get to do is the things with you, and we get to work with a lot of different folks, especially here in the Montrose area. We have Montrose is one of our Main Street program towns. Congratulations on the folks here for that. And Ridgeway as well is one of our Main Street towns as well. And so we're happy to be a part of that. The other part that we work a lot on is both low middle income housing and homelessness. And we've partnered a lot with Montrose. I know you've had a lot of great work here in both the private sector and the not-for-profit sector working on that issue. We're the folks that are the lead agency, although we have a lot of partners on it, with Fort Lyon, a operation, if you've read about it, that is really providing a unique new opportunity for homeless folks who have tried everything else. And I'll tell you, I've been out there twice now. I'm getting ready to go out a third time here in September. You meet these folks, and their lives have changed. And so we are very grateful both to the legislature and all those who have helped us with that, and that operation continues. We've had about 58 graduates so far. Of those, about 10 of them are no longer on any kind of public assistance at all. Their lives have completely turned around. Many of the others, their lives have turned around, but they're still needing a little help. But it's a great program, and you should be proud of our state for taking that on in the many places that it does.
That was Irv Halter, the executive director of the Colorado Department of Local Affairs. Next, we'll hear from John Schwartout, a senior advisor to the governor.
Thanks, Irv. Before I start talking about Gunnison sage-grouse, which is relevant to this county, I think it's important to set up the context for this within the Endangered Species Act. It was a noble intent to create an act that would help preserve and protect species into the long run. But at the time the act was passed, there was one issue that was unresolved, and that was whether or not a listing would be about the species itself, about the critters or plants, or whether it would be about the habitat that these species use. And the debate lasted for over a year, and it was finally decided that it would be the species that would be listed and not the habitat, because the species would carry more of a public image that would help in its protection and long-term viability. But the conflict never went away, and as we've seen with the Endangered Species Act since its inception, it's been litigated ever since, because the people that didn't get habitat designation have been fighting and suing over it ever since. And about 30 years ago, Colorado decided, when this became adversarial, I mean, it instantly became a dual structure, species versus communities, species versus ranchers, species versus agriculture. And Colorado took a look at that. As a matter of fact, it was Governor Roy Romer, and he said, you know, I'd rather have a partner than an adversary. And isn't there something the state of Colorado can do to create conditions on the ground that are about partnership and about working together to benefit the species, but keeping our economies whole at the same time? And we put a lot of money behind it, and the state pursued this through every governor, including this governor. this idea that we could do something through partnership to alleviate the negative aspects of the Endangered Species Act, because it really wasn't any more about saving the species as much as it was about listing them, so that people, once it's listed, they think the problem has been solved. And what we found was that that's not the case. The work just begins then. And if we can do that work before a listing, that makes a lot of sense. And so that's been Colorado's policy for many years. And what we did was we spent the money to develop science at Colorado Parks and Wildlife so that the state of Colorado would be the holder of the best scientific information about these species, even more than the federal government. And we started working in partnership with agriculture and private landowners to develop conservation strategies to alleviate some of the pressure so that these species don't need to be listed. And the idea was balance. The idea is that you can balance these things. It doesn't have to be either or. It can be a balance of all of the above. And nowhere has that model, Colorado's model, played out more than when Gunnison sage grouse. The state spent, just the state alone has spent $40 million to protect the Gunnison sage grouse, but the state isn't really the driver of this. The driver of this was the counties and the landowners working to preserve this species. They didn't want a listing, but beyond that, they wanted healthy populations. It was a small number of these birds. And you can't do better than what Colorado's local governments have done, including Montrose and Delta and Gunnison County and the Dolores County and the other county. You can't do better. And so when the federal government settled a lawsuit and then gave a timetable for listing or not listing these species, the situation became kind of acute. And so we made it really clear that if these local efforts weren't, well, I didn't make it clear, the governor made it clear, that if these local efforts weren't recognized and weren't valued, because ultimately it's about recovering these species, not listing them. And the only way you can recover them is the effort that these counties have done. So Colorado threatened to file a lawsuit. We have filed a lawsuit in federal court. Filing alongside of us is Gunnison County and the Gunnison stock growers, as well as the state of Utah and San Juan County in Utah, and other counties may very well file. But the importance is this is more than about sage grouse. This is a protecting an approach that works, a proactive, collaborative approach that has been successful and served Colorado very well for 30 years. That's what we're protecting. 2 years ago, we passed bipartisan legislation. I think there was only one no vote in the legislature on it, to take some money from the Species Conservation Fund and hire a permanent attorney at the Attorney General's office who would specialize in endangered species. And we're fortunate that we have capable counsel. We're fortunate that that counsel is working collaboratively with Gunnison County's attorney and with the stock growers attorney and others that might file briefs. But we really need to be successful, because what we're protecting is trying to steer us out of this polarization where it's either or. I mean, there's so much rides on this. And I can't tell you, I've been on properties in most of the counties where landowners have really taken the initiative to protect these species and protect their way of life. And we've gotten funding from Great Outdoors Colorado, Colorado Parks and Wildlife, private foundations, the federal government. I mean, this has to work. It isn't adversarial with the Secretary of Interior. They're in a bad spot, but this is something we need to succeed at. We need to have the backs of these counties and these landowners that have put it all on the line to try to make this approach work.
That was John Schwartout, a senior advisor to the governor. You are listening to Local Motion on KVNF. I'm Laura Palmisano. Up next, we'll hear a speech Governor John Hickenlooper gave at a community forum in Montrose last month.
I'm going to speak for 10 minutes, if I'm any good. I'll cut this in tight and then let you guys all ask questions. And then we have all these folks, as busy as they are, came all the way out here just to make sure that you could get real answers from the people that actually direct these agencies. And, you know, the inspiration was many years ago when Roy Romer was governor, he used to call it Dome on the Range, and he would take several cabinet members out and go and just let people ask questions so they could ask whatever they want, unfiltered, and we'd have people who had first-hand knowledge of what the issues would be. Obviously, the Animas River was a disaster of the first magnitude. The response from the EPA was much, much less than they expected themselves. I think the imagery of that yellow river, you know, second day I got called up to be interviewed by the BBC, right, in London. And so that image obviously went around the globe. To their credit, the EPA came out, and I don't think I've ever seen a federal agency do it this fast, where the head of the EPA, Gina McCarthy, said, it was our fault. We're going to take responsibility. We're going to hold ourselves to the same high standards we'd hold any private company that polluted. We're going to make people whole. The raft operators, whatever damages we cause, we'll fix. And I could only imagine their lawyers saying, she said what? You know, but it, in a funny way, that's the way a federal agency should work, right? They should, when they make a mistake, they should admit it. They should say they're going to fix it. And then they should go forward and fix it. So I will tell you that I've talked to her four times since the event happened, most recently two nights ago, and I think she is hell-bent for leather, as my grandfather used to say. I think she's very focused on actually making sure that we get that river back to better than it was before. And my ill-fated, you know, I got very frustrated because the EPA wouldn't. They have a protocol that says they got to wait 7 days. They've got to have clean water tests after a pollution event, 7 days before they can let people back in the water. Well, we could see from measurements of the acidity and the early chemistry that there was a big surge for about 8 hours. That's how long it took for all this polluted water to go into the Animas, right? And then it surged, went right through Durango. And then the river came back to normal. And we had 108 fish in cages all along the river there. Only one of those fish died, and he died before the real surge started. A lot of the creepy crawlers on the, you know, the what they call benthic invertebrates, they all survived. I mean, in a funny way, we might have dodged a bullet there, and the surge went through without leaving. There wasn't super high levels of arsenic. There weren't super high levels of some of the other really toxic, health-threatening chemicals. And so we saw that the river was back to its pre-event status, which, again, is not great, right? I mean, there's a lot of mines up there leaking heavy metals in as a kind of a regular basis. But certainly you could go back to rafting. And yet it seemed like for a while there the EPA was going to require those 7 days. And so the whole point of drinking the water, taking the two gulps of water after putting in iodide, right, on camera and making sure everyone knew you're not supposed to drink river water. It's not a good idea. But we wanted the rest of the world to see that Durango was open for business, right? Now, or if it wasn't within the next couple of days, it was going to be open for business. And this wasn't, you know, the debilitating environmental disaster that we've seen so often. The Love Canal, I mean, other places on the East Coast where it takes literally decades and decades and decades and Superfund resources to recover from it. I hope and I believe that the EPA is going to help find the money so that we can actually put a treatment facility up by Silverton for all those mines, not just the Gold King, and really address this is one of the most dangerous grouping of mines we have in terms of heavy metal pollution in the state of Colorado. And if there's a silver lining, there's two silver lines maybe, that the pollution went through and did not leave lasting, you know, irreversible damages. And then two, it was a wake-up call that we'll get those resources to do a treatment center that, I mean, this will not be inexpensive, and I think the EPA is going to step up and help figure out how do we get this funded. So that would be a reasonable silver lining. Colorado, and you guys all know this, it is not even all over the state, but we've went through some very tough challenges after 2008, 2009, 2010, and now in almost every measure, the state is doing literally better than almost any other state in the country. When you look at the overall startups, the business growth, the Forbes magazine ranked, you know, the top 200 cities for business and workforce, and five of the top 40 were all in Colorado. But I think we recognize that that's not universal all over the state, and we recognize that even though government doesn't create the jobs and we don't, trust me, I was an entrepreneur and I put everything I owned on the line to start my business back in 1988. And there's a difference, right? When it's your money and your aunt's money and your old Little League baseball coach's money, you take those that a lot more seriously. Government can be a stronger partner, though. And we are, again, accelerating our effort to get more regulations taken off the books, trying to figure out ways we can take the friction out of the relationship between business and government. I think we can be a better partner. In this last year, the state partnered with Montrose with over $500,000 in grants and loans and tax credits for local businesses, mostly focused around job creation. I think we're going to see benefits. So we did a fair number of branding. We gave a relatively small amount of tax credits to that the movie Quentin Tarantino's Hateful Eight, which now the trailer's out, which looks like kind of a grim movie to me, just to be blunt. But the landscape up around Telluride and Ridgeway between there, I think, is going to be spectacular. And I think that those images do put us at our best. We started the Colorado Blueprint 2.0. I know a number of people here helped us when we did the first Colorado Blueprint back in 2010. This is updating it, going around having listening seminars, trying to take in what the positive developments have been, what the challenges have been. You know, where do our counties and our local communities see new opportunities? How can incentives and grants help accelerate those businesses to get started? We recognize that the businesses are only as good as the employees that they've got, and we are going to continue to push very hard on workforce. We were just down at a Dowdy's machine shop down in Delta, and just looking at how the fellow who runs that, he never went to college, and he had, back in those days, we had an apprenticeship program that the state ran so that he could go out, and over a course of 2 years, he took a couple courses at the vocational school, but basically he was out working for other businesses learning how to be a machinist. We got the legislation passed so that we can set up some, now they're called experiential learning centers. But it's the same darn thing, right? It's going to allow employers to take young people in even before they finished high school, give them a taste of what the job looks like, what the field looks like, partner with community colleges or other higher education and give them, you know, degrees or certificates or badges. We're also working with the Markle Foundation to help create a website, probably with that company LinkedIn. I don't know if you've ever seen, but LinkedIn, I joined it and it drives me nuts. They send me stuff every day. Everybody and their uncle wants to link in with me. And so I just don't have the time. So if I've non-linked with anybody here, I apologize. But I think they are, it's a great platform by which, as you go through life, every degree, you get your high school degree, you get a badge, you learn welding, you learn how to run a certain type of machines in a machine shop. This will be able to track everyone's badges and certificates. Even if you just go and you're working at Walmart and you're learning how they do inventory, right, you'll be able to mark down and have it, anytime you're applying for a job, have them see exactly what your work experience is. And I think having a centralized place for this and using that to really look at how we monitor and help prepare kids for their careers, having that centralized place where employers can go will be a great benefit. Obviously, we've put a big priority on this whole, all the veterans that are coming back from combat in the Middle East. You want a good employee, hire a veteran. And our goal, I'm not sure we're going to get there this year, but our goal is to get, so we want to be functionally zero employment, which is about 98% employed. So everybody who's coming back from combat, our goal is to have at least 98% of them employed. And hopefully we'll get pretty darn close to that by the end of this year. Oops, I've only got 2 minutes. I better hustle. Obviously, another big part of this is broadband. And if we're going to try, as we use our tourism marketing to get people to come out and do vacations in Colorado, the idea is that some of those young entrepreneurs will choose to settle and start their small business in a rural part of Colorado. But to do that, we've got to make sure we've got broadband everywhere. In the 2014 legislative session, we did telecom reform. DOLA's been giving out, I think they spent $5.2 million and have $5.2 million for broadband development in Montrose and Delta counties. We're putting together that comprehensive plan. To say we're underfunded is putting it lightly, but I think that we have the consensus that this, pretty much everybody, even along the front range, recognizes that this is what electricity and telephones were to this country in the 1920s, and at that point, the urban areas put up the money to make sure that everyone in the country could afford to have a telephone and could get electricity. I think broadband is no less an important utility at this day and age. We're looking for other ways to push rural economic development. We formed the Office of Outdoor Recreation, so I think we're only the second state in the country, but in many ways, outdoor recreation does become an opportunity for rural economic development. A friend of mine, or acquaintance in South Dakota, was telling me that tourism is the front door of economic development. And outdoor recreation, if we do it properly, we should be able to get a lot of these young people to experience our smaller communities. And once they experience them, again, not everybody, but we'll sliver off, a certain percentage are going to say, hey, I could live here. I could raise a family here. I could build my business here. We're also going to continue to focus on, within that outdoor recreation industry, what we call Colorado the Beautiful, this notion that we need to get kids out more. This is a staggering statistic. Nationwide, average all kids 12 years and younger spend an average now of about 7 minutes a day in unstructured outdoor activity, right? Just walking around, looking at bugs, hanging out, 7 minutes. Right? Think about when you were kids. Those same kids are spending 6 to 9 hours a day looking at some screen somewhere. That's all of our responsibility. That's us, our children, our parents, our cousins. And I think the notion, part of Colorado the Beautiful is that, and again, it's not as difficult a task out here, but we want, in everywhere in the state, we want to make sure that every kid in Colorado is within a 10-minute walk of a vibrant green space, someplace where they can explore, and someplace that will hopefully attract them and give them incentive to get away from that screen. Right now, of our kids in Colorado, almost a quarter, 23%, are obese, right? Not just overweight, but they are obese. And that will, again, the healthcare consequences of that will be dramatic if we don't do anything about it. We're also still trying to define Colorado as the healthiest state. We had a list of the things where we were not good. Prescription drug abuse, we were down near in the bottom quarter, so we've took that on 3 years ago. We've now reduced prescription drug abuse by over 15%. Hopefully we'll get to about 21 or 22% this year. We were one of the worst states for teenage pregnancy, and this got to be a little controversial, but we got foundation grants who offered long-acting reversible contraception. So these are like IUDs and implants, but to low-income families, and in every case, our clinics always said abstinence is the right way to go. The first discussion was, if you're a teenager, you should not be having sex. No question. But if you're going to make a mistake, don't compound it with a second mistake. And these long-acting reversible contraception forms are much more effective. And we, in Colorado, over the last 4 years, we reduced our teenage pregnancy by 42%, right? And at the same time, teenage abortion dropped by 35%. So, I mean, anyway, I'm going to run through. I'm just going to finish up because I'm obviously speaking too. They give me too much stuff. It's not my fault. All right, well, maybe I took a little too long to talk. A healthy state is not just healthy minds, right, and healthy bodies, but it's also we've got to have infrastructure. And as the state continues to do well, our roads, we are so far behind Utah, so far behind Nebraska. I mean, almost, it's now more than half the states in the West have increased their gas tax in the last, I think it's 3 years. Our tax hasn't been changed since 1992. So there's no inflation. You can imagine we can't buy what we used to buy. And I think at a certain point, we're just going to have to start talking about it, and I don't know what other way there is to fix the roads, but that's that at least would allow us to do maintenance if we had a modest increase to the gas tax. But again, unless the rural Colorado leads that charge, and trust me, your roads, you have more to gain from this than anybody else because you've got more miles of road per person. So a lot of the resources to that increase in any kind of gas tax is going to get disproportionately spent in making sure that these roads get improved. And I've now twice driven into Utah from Colorado and seen the condition of the Colorado roads, and then you get into Utah and you see the condition of the Utah roads, it's night and day. And it's something that none of us should be proud about. The other thing, just in terms of resources, we have since Referendum C, and we said, all right, we're going to keep Tabor, and we're not going to raise taxes without voting on them, and we're going to set a new limit. And we said we're going to set that limit in 2008. And at that point, we said, all right, from now on, the growth in state spending cannot exceed inflation plus population growth. And so we set that. In 2009, independently of that, all the hospitals came to the legislature and they said, we're getting killed because we've got all these people coming, low-income families coming to our emergency rooms. We're having to provide them medical attention, and we don't get compensated. We're going broke. And they said, we want to have a fee that on per hospital bed that so that we can be compensated for that, and we'll take the money. It won't go in the general fund. It'll be a real fee, and we'll use that to match with the federal government. Will match it 50-50, and that will allow us to get compensated for that care. So that hospital provider fee last year was $450 million, and for whatever reason, it wasn't called a fee. It contributes into Tabor. So if you take the hospital provider fee out, and you go back to 2008, and you look at the growth of our spending, and then you look at inflation plus population growth, we are still under Tabor, right? In other words, we have restrained the growth of government just the way Tabor was intended. But with that hospital provider fee in, we're going to have to do a big refund. And the challenge is, if we didn't have the hospital provider fee calculated within that cap, we would be getting about $215 million a year. There was legislation passed in 2010 that would put $212 or $215 million towards transportation year after year. So with the interest rates so low, we could go out and bond that. We could get about $3 billion. And so you talk about really trying to address the issues of roads in the state without, you know, in this case, without having to raise taxes at all. That's a pretty compelling vision. If we don't now, if we leave it just the way it is, we'll start giving refunds. And trust me, as an elected official, nothing is more popular than giving refunds. So politically, I'm all for it. I have no problem. But I don't know where else we're going to get those kinds of resources to really begin to make sure our infrastructure is state-of-the-art. And again, Utah has half the population we do, and they are spending twice as much money as we are on their roads. And it's, you know, not right away, but eventually that will come up, that will catch us, and we will begin to lose jobs and businesses to our neighboring states. So I'll finish with that and just say, again, if we give, you know, the $40, $60, I think it could be $80 refunds in a few years, politically very, very popular. But we have to figure out some way that we're going to address these infrastructure needs or we'll have a real competitive disadvantage. Anyway, thank you for being here. It certainly makes me so appreciative to have you all come out and ask questions and listen. And part, one of the big challenges, I think, with democracy is now with all the digital stuff, people are so busy, they don't bother to pay attention anymore. So I am very, very grateful for you all being here.
That was Governor John Hickenlooper. You've been listening to Local Motion on KVNF. I'm Laura Palmisano. Stay tuned for As the Worm Turns coming up next.